Okay, so I'd just like to welcome everybody to the first spotlight hosted by me. I think most of you know me, but just in case there's anyone who doesn't, I'm Steve, located in the centre of England in the UK, where we've got a gorgeous day for a change. And just before we start, I'd just like to say a few thank yous. I'd like to say thank you to Becky for coordinating spotlight for us. I'd like to say thank you in his absence to Lou for his participation in the past. I'd like to say thank you to Steve on this occasion for doing the recording. And now I'd like to just sit back and relax and listen to what I think is probably going to be a very interesting program, as I introduce to you Marlene Nord, who is better known to all of us as Country Music Mar. We all know Marlene's got great talent for singing, and we'll obviously come on to that later. But first of all, Marlene, can I just welcome you? Thank you for agreeing to be interviewed. And can I start off by asking you where you were born and when, if you wouldn't mind telling us?
Well, I was born in a little town in Wisconsin called Clintonville. And I guess what happened was that my parents were just down there visiting, and I decided to greet the world 3 months early. And so they rushed my mom to the hospital, and I came forth. And I don't remember that town at all, because my parents were in the process of moving to a little town called Woodruff, Wisconsin. I was born on February 1st, 1959, at 2:30 a.m., they said. So I woke my mom up. Wasn't that nice of me?
It certainly was. What a lovely surprise. For my benefit, more than any one's benefit, because of course I'm a long way from you, can you just tell us a little bit about that part of the United States, maybe for people who aren't familiar with it either, because I know it's a big place over there. Can you just give us a little feel for what the area is like?
Well, Wisconsin is located in the north central part of the country. It is bordered by Upper Michigan on the north and Lake Michigan on the east, and Minnesota on the west and Illinois on the south. So it's up north a ways, and I think part of Lake Superior also borders it. And Clintonville is in the east, I think the east central part of the state, fairly close to Lake Michigan, but I don't think it's quite over that far. Like I said, I don't know a whole lot about the area because I never experienced it much. I was in the hospital for 3 months after I was born because I only weighed 2 pounds, 6 ounces. And so my parents, during the time I was in the hospital, were in the process of moving to Woodruff, which is actually a town in north central Wisconsin. And so that's way up north, a lot of lakes up there, and a big resort area.
Okay, thanks for that. That's very interesting. It gives me a little bit of a feel for, you know, where you were actually born. You said you were in hospital for 3 months, and was that due to premature birth or something like that? I take it you've always been totally blind, or maybe you have some sight, I'm not sure. But I'm guessing that that's probably why you were in hospital all that length of time.
Yep, that's a correct assumption. And the reason I was in the hospital was due to my premature birth. I needed extra oxygen, and of course the oxygen damaged my eyes, the classic RLF or ROP thing, whatever people want to call it these days. And so I think I only weighed 5 pounds when I actually got out of the hospital, and I weighed 2 pounds, 6 ounces when I was born. I don't know if I mentioned that or not, but I was an itty-bitty.
Yes, I thought that was probably the case, Marlene, because I think a lot of people of our generation, because I'm, you know, roughly the same age as yourself, were born oxygen blinded. I wasn't, but I know lots of people that were. So, you know, I was sort of guessing that that's what you were going to actually say. So when you eventually got out of hospital, you went home to join your parents. Do you have any brothers or sisters? Are they older than you, younger than you, or are you an only child?
I was basically raised as an only child. My parents each were married previous to the time that they were married, and they each had a child. My half-brother was old enough to be my father, and so he was out of the house before I came along. My half-sister lived with her mom exclusively, and I wouldn't know her if I met her on the street. The last time I saw her was when I was about 6 years old, and she's 10 years older than me, so I was basically raised as an only child.
Yeah, but having a stepbrother so much older than yourself, I suppose, it wasn't really like having a stepbrother, was it? Were you living together as a family unit at that time?
No, he was out on his own. In fact, he had gone into the service, and my parents believe that one of the circumstances that may have brought on my premature birth is that my half-brother came home from the service and hitched a ride and got into an accident and wound up having to have his leg amputated. It was strange because I guess he came through the service totally unscathed, but he came home and that happened to him. So I guess that really upset my mom. And shortly after I was born, my half-brother got married and started having a family. I have a nephew that's only 2.5 years younger than me.
Yeah, okay, I understand that. Yes, that must have been a horrible experience for your mum to have to go through, and your stepbrother, of course. Horrible thing to happen to anyone. So what about your parents? What did your dad do for an occupation?
My dad, after we moved into the house, we moved into an old farmhouse that they had to totally renovate. There wasn't even any indoor plumbing in the house.
Mar is talking about her father now.
Working for a cement company, and he drove cement truck, and then he did that for like 20 years, and that's what he did all the while I was growing up. And then when I went off to the school for the blind in Wisconsin, my mom began to do the accounting for the same business that my dad worked at. So there you go.
So with your dad being a truck driver, was that long distance? Was he away from home for long periods? Were there periods when you didn't see him from, say, Monday to Friday, or was it local?
It was all local. He would go out on a run in the morning and deliver the cement, pour the cement wherever it needed to be poured, and of course finish it and do all the stuff, you know, putting in a cement floor, sidewalk, or whatever requires, and then he'd come home. Generally, he worked about a 50-mile radius, so he was never gone overnight.
Okay, would you like to tell us a little bit about your early childhood, you know, preschool? What sort of childhood did you have? Were you a mischievous little girl, or were you a good little girl? Did you get into scrapes? Were you allowed to, you know, play with local kids in the neighborhood, or were you, as so many of us blind kids from birth, you know, we tend to be wrapped in cotton wool a little bit? What sort of a little girl, what sort of a childhood did you have?
I was very imaginative, and we lived out in the country, so I didn't have a whole lot of interaction with other kids on a regular basis. I remember my folks had, talk about mischievous. My folks had these friends, and their names were George and Gail, and they had four bratty boys. And I hated going over there because they were loud people. They were always yelling at their kids. So one day they were going to go over to visit them, and I made up my mind that I wasn't going to go. I know I was not even in kindergarten yet. And I said, I'm not going. I'm staying home. And my dad, you know, they kept saying, oh, well, you have to go. You know, you can't stay home by yourself. I'm staying home by myself. You can go. I don't want to go. So finally my dad got fed up with me and said, if you say that one more time, I'm going to lower the boom on you. Well, whenever he said that, I knew that that meant that I was going to get my rear end paddled. Well, I said it one too many times. He comes over there. I was sitting on a kitchen chair, and I put my little hands on the bottom of that chair, and I figured I was going to stick myself there. Well, needless to say, Daddy's hands are a whole lot stronger than little girl's hands, and he pried my little hands off of there and gave it to me good. And I had to go to that bratty boy's house, and I just hated it. So that was my real mischievous moment that I remember when I was a kid.
Oh, dear. I bet you can still feel it now. Yeah, sounds... oh, dear. Poor Marlene. Anyway, I don't think it did you too much harm, did it? So how did you amuse yourself then during this period, preschool, you know, if you didn't interact much with other kids? What did you do to keep yourself occupied?
Well, here's my prerequisite to music and recording and radio and stuff like that. I loved music. And I remember the first record player I ever had was this little suitcase type thing that you unzipped and plugged, you know, and I think my dad found it in the dump. That was during the days when the dumps were open for scavenging, and I knew more people that dragged resurrected treasures out of that dump and cleaned them up, and people used them for years. And that record player was one of those things. And I used to play records all the time, and then my aunt from California sent us a little reel-to-reel tape recorder. It ran on batteries, and it played 3-inch reels. And the highlight of my day was when my dad would record me. And I kept bugging him to record me all the time. I just thought that was the coolest thing, hearing my voice back at me.
It's amazing, isn't it, how many parallels there are between lots of us, because it's exactly the same for me. You know, the first record player, the excitement of having the first record player and the reel-to-reel tape recorder. And I think a lot of us have experienced that, and I think that's where we learned our love of all this technology. I'm sure that's why we're sitting here now and I'm talking to you in the States and I'm here in England. I'm sure we can thank those early days of being introduced to the mysteries of record players and reel-to-reel tape machines and even wind-up record players. So that's how you occupied yourself in the first few years of your life, having a great time. And then I suppose the time came when you had to go to residential school for the blind. Were you forewarned that you'd have to go away to school? Was it explained to you, you know, that you would have to go away from your mum and dad, probably quite a long way? So were you sort of primed beforehand?
I don't really remember anything like that. I just remember... We went down to visit, well, my mom's son, my half-brother, lived in Kenosha, Wisconsin, and then we had some friends in Madison, and they were all within about a 75-mile radius of each other, but they were 250 miles from my folks. And I remember when my folks left me off at the school for the first time, and they went away, I was so scared and so sad, and It was a tough thing for me because I never dealt with a lot of other kids, and I really had some growing pains when that happened. I remember, you know, I always had my own things, and I never had to share. And so I never really had occasion to share, or my parents never really taught me to share. And they had these little things called fiddlesticks. They were little plastic strips with little notches in them, and you could build things out of them. Well, I wanted to play with the fiddlesticks. Well, actually, I was playing with the fiddlesticks, and this other girl named Carla wanted to play with the fiddlesticks. And I wouldn't let her, and so she took them away from me, and I bit her. I got in trouble for that, needless to say, but I just didn't know any better. You know, I was frustrated.
I bet you were, too. I can just imagine it being, you know, as I've been through it myself. How old were you at this stage? Probably about five. I think they send kids away to school, well, they used to, about 5 years old. If you didn't go to nursery school for the blind, which we had over here. So how old were you then? About five?
Yeah, I was five. And I remember I had an aunt, a wonderful aunt, that was my mom's sister that never had any children. And she lived in Kenosha, about 75 miles away. So it got to where she would take me to her house on weekends. So I didn't have to stay there all the time. But I remember the first time she was going to come and pick me up, she got lost or something happened, and she didn't come when she said she was going to come, and I thought for sure she'd forgotten about me. And I was so sad. I remember just about getting sick. I was sobbing so hard because I thought she'd forgotten me. And so when she showed up, I said, "I thought you forgot me." And she said, "No, I got lost."
Oh, poor Molly. Yeah, it's terrible, isn't it? Yeah, I can sympathise with you. But did you settle down in the end? You know, after a few weeks, did you begin to settle down and make friends?
Oh yeah. I mean, you know, I guess I was always had the ability to be fairly social, I suppose. You know, I got to know people I settled down. I still had my sad moments. I was kind of the school crybaby, I guess. A lot of that comes from the fact that I was really sheltered by my parents, and I experienced a lot of growing pains because of that, and it was kind of a common thread that ran through my whole life and made certain things about growing up very difficult for me.
Yeah, yeah. And the subjects taught at the in those days, what sort of lessons were you having when you very first went there, if you can remember? Or, you know, it must be difficult thinking back to when you were five, but any idea of what you were taught, first of all?
Well, I remember learning puzzles, which I was not good at. I remember doing some arithmetic. We called it arithmetic back then, not math like they do now. I don't know what the difference between arithmetic and mathematics is, but anyway, maybe somebody will explain that to me one of these days. But I remember that in kindergarten, you know, doing a couple of counting things, like counting bumps on a piece of paper. And I remember learning how to build things with building blocks and things like that. And I remember one of the first music experiences I had was we had a teacher, the kindergarten teacher at that day, her name was Miss Jean, and she told us, they had a piano in the class, and she told us that we weren't supposed to touch the piano. Well, I was always so intrigued with pianos. And so anyway, she left the classroom, and I went over and started playing little tunes on the piano. And, of course, when you're a blind person, somebody can sneak up on you. So, anyway, she was listening to me, and I had no idea she was there. And so after I got finished, she said, "Marlene," and I thought, uh-oh, I'm in trouble now. And she said, "Do that again." So whatever it was I did, like Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star or something. And she said, "You've got some talent. You should be taking lessons." So that was one of the only times in my life where it paid to be naughty.
Yes, and look where it's got you. That's fantastic, isn't it? What a lovely story. Yeah, because they're usually pretty strict in the schools for the blind. Well, they were. I suppose they still are now. Would you say that it was a strict regime? You know, did you have to toe the line, all you kids? Or were they pretty lenient? I think I know what you're going to say, though.
Well, actually, I think it got more lenient as I grew up. It was pretty regimented when I was younger. In fact, we always called it the Braille Jail. But, you know, I can remember having to ask to go outside, and I didn't understand all this stuff. I got to tell you a story from school. Talk about being a mischievous kid. One time, they had a big old snowstorm, and so they called up all the parents and told them not to come and pick up the kids because the roads were bad and they didn't want anybody out on the roads. And at that time, I think I was in like first grade, and we stayed in this big dormitory room. There was like 30 girls with little itty-bitty cots all in, there was like two rows with an aisle between the two rows. And between each of these cots were chairs that they laid out our clothes for the next day on. Well, I got this lovely bright idea that since we were all going to have to stay at school, that we should take all those chairs and clothes out from between the beds, throw them in a big pile in the aisle in the middle of the room, and push all of our beds together so we could be together. So, you know, we had a wooden floor, and so, you know, as soon as we started doing this, the house parent heard us, and she came in, and she saw us rearranging the furniture, and she said, "Okay, whose idea was this?" Well, needless to say, I all of a sudden shut up my trap real tight, and somebody has to be a tattletale, of course. And they said, "Marlene did it." And she said, "Marlene, did you do it?" And I said, "Yeah." She said, "Are you sorry?" And I said, "No." So she grabbed me by my shoulders and she ran me into the bathroom and sat me on a chair. And she said, "You stay there until you can tell me you're sorry." I said, "Okay, I'll stay here all night because I'm not sorry." So she left, and I sat there and sat there, and my eyelids got droopier and droopier. So finally I figured if I could tell her I'm sorry, I can go to bed. So I went into her room, and I told her I was sorry, but boy, it took me a long time to reach that stage.
Oh, that's great. I can just imagine it. I really can just imagine that happening, and good on you. Good on you for fighting back a bit, because they were strict old places, weren't they? They really were. You know, as I say, maybe they're a bit more lenient now, if indeed they exist. Lots of residential schools for the blind, but they were strict places. So good on you, Marlene. I approve all these years later. Good on you. So let's jump forward a little bit then. You progressed in school, and did you stay at the same school all your school days, or did you move on to a different school for the blind?
Nope, I stayed there from kindergarten through 12th grade.
Right, okay, because over here we wouldn't do that. We would go on to a different school, so that's interesting. So you've got a very big age range. Did you have any contact with the older children when you were younger, or were you kept strictly separated?
I remember when we were in the primary building, this was before they moved us to the big dorm, and I remember the bigger kids, especially on weekends, used to come over and play games with us and things like that. And some of them would come over and help with, like, giving us baths and stuff. So I do remember some contact with them, but I always thought that they were grown-ups. I didn't think they were kids.
That's very understandable, very understandable. So you stayed at the same establishment all those years, and during that time, what were your favourite subjects, you know, when you really got into the School for the Blind culture? What did you like being taught best?
Well, when I was younger, I think my favourite classes were the music classes. And as I got older and got into academics, my favorite classes were language and or English, you know, and spelling, things like that. I was never into the physical education or anything like that, but I did pretty well in the language arts type things.
Okay, that's fine. And you're going to have to help me with the terminology over here, this side. Do you say when did you graduate? Because we don't use that expression.
Yes, I graduated in 1977.
And over here we do A levels, O levels for leaving school. Any exams taken or passed or whatever at that stage?
I remember taking some sort of a routine exam that all the kids were given. I was not very scholarly, I'm afraid. My interests were not in learning in those days, and I kind of wish that they had been a little more. I might be more intelligent, but oh well, you know, you can't redo it. And so I became so interested in music in my early teen years that learning was not a priority on my list.
Okay, well, you've cued us very, very nicely into the next section of Spotlight for this occasion, and I think I'll let you take a little bit of a break now. So I know you've got some music lined up, and it seems a very appropriate place just before we carry on with your teenage years, where you really began to get into music, I imagine, if we heard a song from you. So I'll let you introduce the song, and we'll just sit back and enjoy it.
Okay. Well, I'm going to play a song that I just think it would be a great one to open a music portion. And I'll just kind of give you some background as far as my music goes. I began singing professionally, which means that I was gainfully employed when I was 14. And I always liked country classics, and this one is a great song. And I think I like peppy songs and positive songs, and this is definitely one. So this is my version of the great Hank Williams classic, Hey Good Lookin'.
Hey good looking, what you got cooking? How's about cooking something up with me? Hey sweet baby, now don't you think maybe we could find us a brand new recipe? I got a hot rod Ford and a $2 bill, and I know a spot right over the hill. There's soda pop and the dancing free, so if you want to have fun, come along with me. Hey, good looking, what you got cooking? Now how's about cooking something up with me? so we can go steady. How's about saving all your time for me? No more looking, I know I've been tooken. How's about keeping steady company? I'm gonna throw my date book over the fence and buy me one for 5 or 10 cents and keep it till it's covered with age, 'cause I'm writing your name down on every page. Hey, good looking, what you got cooking? Now how's about cooking something up? How's about cooking something up? How's about cooking something up with me?
Hey Marlene, that was fantastic. That was great. And, you know, I even know that song myself. I couldn't perform it, but I do know it. I am familiar with it. I'll just give you a few seconds in case you've got to change any soundcard settings so you can speak to me. So I'll just ramble on for a few seconds just until you maybe have got the opportunity to reset your microphone. And I'll let up on the key now and see if you're back with me.
Actually, I can have my mic going and my music at the same time, so that's no problem.
Oh, that's fine. Just didn't want to catch you out there. I know it's terrible when you panic trying to redo your settings when somebody's speaking to you. So, you've left school, and we're now with the teenage Marlene. Were you Marlene Nord at that time, or were you Marlene something else? Because I honestly don't know if you married or not. Were you Marlene Nord in those days?
No, I was married for 17 years, but my maiden name is Neff, N-E-F-F, as in Frank. And so I really didn't change my name a whole lot, just three letters.
Yeah, so we've got you, now you've left school, and you've decided that academia isn't for you, so you went back home, I take it, after leaving school to live with family. And what sort of teenager were you? Were you a rebellious teenager or a quiet teenager? What sort of teenage years did you have? And we'll come on to the music shortly, but I just want to find out a little bit about the teenage Marlene.
Actually, I was kind of a square. I wasn't one of the real popular girls, and I was raised, you know, by parents that were 35 and 40 years older than me, and of course all my aunts and everything were older than they should have been, you know, the traditional age between parents and aunts and uncles and kids. They were more like my grandparents, really. And so I, a lot of times, dressed behind the times because, of course, I didn't know any better. And I was called names and things like that. I hate to get on that stuff. It sounds like I'm feeling sorry for myself, but it was just the plain truth. I was not one of the popular kids. I had my own circle of friends, and, of course, I was doubly unpopular because I liked country music. And back in those days, like Barbara Mandrell says, I was country when country wasn't cool.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying. You said before the song that your first professional singing engagement was when you were 14, so it's pretty obvious that from a very early age that's what you wanted to do. But if you hadn't gone into singing, what was your fallback? What plans had you got for future career if singing hadn't been it?
I really had no groundwork laid there. I must be honest. You know, everybody kept trying to get me to be a teacher or whatever, and I had no interest. And So, you know, I didn't go to college or anything like that. I was so hell-bent in those days that I was going to be a star. And no one told me that that doesn't happen to just everybody. You know, I just figured if you worked hard enough at it, you'd get there.
Yeah, yeah. it's a dream, isn't it? And that's no bad thing to, you know, to have a burning ambition. I think that's what drives a lot of musicians and artists and writers on, you know, this belief that you're going to make it no matter what. So during this period after school, after you left school, and you were at home, were you out and about with your friends? Did you go on dates and things like that?
No, I never really went on dates until I met the man that I married. I was very naive. I lived at home. I tried to get my mother to allow me to have an apartment in the town where they live so that I could get used to living on my own, but my mom wouldn't hear of it. I think she figured that she had been robbed of my presence for 18 years of my life, and she didn't want me leaving home. You know, she was very... we had some horrible fights about that, because I knew that for my own personal betterment that it would have been a good thing for me to get out on my own and start to experience life. And I don't know that I would have married quite so... I mean, I was 22 when I married, so that isn't real early, but I was basically, in a lot of ways, still 17, 18 years old. I don't think I would have married so soon if I would have had the opportunity to get out on my own and experience life, but I think I kind of used that situation to get out of my home and to get out on my own, because obviously it forced me to do so.
Yeah, I think a lot of us are, you know, protected by our parents and not allowed to do things. I mean, they send this little kid off to school and they don't realize that in the interim period you've actually grown up and you're quite capable of doing things, and they're scared you're going to hurt yourself, that you can't cope, that you can't manage to do things. And yeah, I know where you're coming from. I really do know where you're coming from, Maureen. So, okay, let's get onto the subject which I'm sure everyone's dying to hear about, and that's the music. You said you were 14 when you did your first professional engagement. Where was that, and how did it come about?
Well, actually, I really shouldn't say that I did my first professional engagement when I was 14. I think I was even younger, because my parents, in 1972, they bought a motel and restaurant combination. And it was during that time that I started working with this band. But even before that, I started performing in the restaurant, like on rainy afternoons, you know, where when they'd have a restaurant full of people. My dad would call me. He was my biggest promoter, you know, and he just thought I was better than anybody. You know how fathers are. And he'd say, "Hey, Marlene, why don't you come over and sing? There's a whole bunch of people in here." And so I had an auto harp at the time, and I'd come over there and sing with my auto harp. And people would give me tips. And I remember at school they had a little credit union, and where you could learn to invest money, and, you know, you'd earn a little interest, and you could borrow from it if you needed to, or you could withdraw from it, and it would be kind of your introduction to banking. And I remember one summer I took $70 back with me and put it into the credit union at school, and man, I thought I was the richest girl in the world. But I remember one Saturday night when I was 14, my folks went to hear this band at a local fireman's ball, I guess is what it was. And there was this acquaintance of my parents that ran this club, and he was off at the time, but he had heard me sing, and he started bugging the band leader about getting me to sing with the band. And the more inebriated he got, the more he bugged the band leader, until the band leader got tired of him bugging him and came and asked me if I'd be interested in singing with the band. And I said, well, I would. And I was scared and shy and everything, but I said, I'm sorry he's making such a pest of himself. And he said, okay, what do you want to do? And I rattled off a whole bunch of songs. And he said, what key do you do the songs in? Well, what I didn't realize at that time was that I told him all the keys of the songs. And what I didn't realize at that time is that I had passed question number one of my qualification test. Because a lot of people want to sing with bands, but nobody knows what key they do things in. And it was a step in the right direction that I did. So anyway, I got up and sang about four songs. First song I ever sang is Satin Sheets, I believe. My dad has a recording of this, and he throws it in my ear every once in a while and drives me nuts. But anyway, that's where I started singing with this band every time I could. And then I got my first keyboard, I think a year later, so I was actually 15 when I started playing and singing with the band. And I was with this band for 11 years.
Right, so that was a very, very profitable little afternoon, wasn't it, when you did that session, the very first one, and you spouted up all the keys. I bet they were surprised. Do you have perfect pitch? And you said you played the auto harp. I've seen an auto harp before. I know you play the piano a little bit. Do you play other instruments, and do you have perfect pitch?
I have relative pitch, I think, because I can, sometimes I can hear a key and know what it is, and sometimes I can't. If I have a piano in front of me, I can find it like just like that, but I don't always have perfect pitch. Also, I played brass instruments in high school in the dance band and orchestra. I played trumpet and French horn. But I don't even know if I could blow a note anymore. I haven't played those things for a long time. I never got into guitar, but I always played keyboard instruments like piano and organ and things like that.
Right, so you were playing with a band, and did you tour the local area? Was it like a touring band? Did you go to weddings and things like that, or did you play concerts with your band?
We actually did a variety of things. A lot of it was local club work and private parties at that time. But I remember the first time I worked with a celebrity, I was 16 years old, and a friend of mine and I, and she was a visually impaired friend from the school that I went to, and this one lady made us matching dresses, and we played on a show with Dave Dudley that recorded 6 Days on the Road, and I was 16 years old at that time.
Okay, so you progressed pretty rapidly then, and obviously you must have been noticed by someone. Someone was got an eye out for you and realized that you were a real talent. And can we come on to the recording? Because you're so interesting, I don't want to overrun the time. It's just racing away. But can we come on to the recording side of things? How did that begin, commercially recording?
Well, actually, I recorded in Nashville, and I wish I had had the foresight to record at least one of those songs off on MP3 so I could have played it for you, but of course I didn't. I recorded in Nashville when I was 19, and this was during the days when I was really pursuing the idea of being a star. And we did three original songs, two of which I had a part of in writing. But somebody put quite a bit of money behind it, because we recorded at the Sound Shop, which at that time was one of the top studios in Nashville. They produced people like Rex Allen Jr. and Conway Twitty and T.G. Shepherd. So nothing ever came of that session, but the experience itself was priceless, and I'll never forget it.
But how did you come to be in that position, from singing with a band to going to record in that studio. What actually happened?
Well, the band leader that ran the band that I was in had some connections, and he actually got it to happen through the connections that he had.
Okay, so you're in a studio. Now, I'm interested, how does the process work? You're in a recording studio, you've got to do a session. As a singer, what actually happens? Can you just talk us through a typical day when you're making a recording? How is it actually achieved?
Well, it depends on what studio. Now, the sound shop, it was really cool because although I didn't actually play piano on my session, I played piano and did all three of the songs, and those session musicians are remarkably amazing to watch. They listen to your song, and while they're listening to your song, they're doing charts of all the chords in the song. And they go in their little corners and they kind of figure out who's going to play where and who's, you know, when the backup singers are going to sing and all this stuff. And 5 minutes later, they converge on the recording area and put that song together like they've been playing it for months. It's just amazing to watch them. In all the other recording situations that I was in, it was our band that did the backup, with the exception of the recording of Hey Good Lookin', and that particular album I used karaoke backups. But I've actually recorded on about five or six albums, starting in with the first recording in 1979 and ending with the last recording in 2000.
Okay, so yeah, that's a good explanation of how it's done. Is it true that they take forever getting the right sound, getting the right drum sound, getting the right guitar sound, getting the right reverb? Do they mess around for hours, or is it just straight, hey, let's do it?
Well, there's quite a bit that goes into it. In fact, I remember when I did the recording in Nashville, the producer, Buddy Killen, was working with a bass player, and there was one bass note that this guy did that just didn't quite come out right on the recording, and they went over and over and over it. And of course, you know, people would get tense and frustrated, and he was great at easing that frustration level when it just got to the point where everybody was about ready to snap. He said, and I don't remember the bass player's name anymore, but he said, at 5 o'clock, if you don't get this right, you will be shot. And of course, everybody laughed. And it just totally broke the tension. So those are the kinds of techniques that if you're really a good recording studio, you have to have these little tricks up your sleeve to be able to ease the stress level.
Yeah, I can imagine it could get a little bit fraught on occasions. And I suppose, you know, you're all professionals, and you learn to solve these little problems that probably crop up from time to time. Now, I'm at a little bit of a disadvantage here, Marlene, because I'm not a great expert on country music. I do like, you know, some country music, but I'm by no means an expert. And I know that you are, and I know that you've worked with a lot of people. I think you've worked with quite a few well-known names. So can you just tell us all who you've worked with? And you'll have to forgive me if I don't recognize the people you're mentioning. Okay, so I'm sure the people stateside will know these people, but I'm afraid I won't. So just let us know who you've worked with.
Okay, well, I hope I can remember everything. The other thing that I did was my ex-husband and I ran a country music production known as the East Central Minnesota Opry in Minnesota. And through that experience, I got the chance to work with quite a few people. But before that, I worked with Marvin Rainwater, Red Simpson, Kenny Price. And these are all older country music artists. And then when we started doing our show, the first celebrity that we worked with was Farron Young. We had the opportunity when we had done a year of our shows, we had an anniversary show, and that show featured Farron Young. I also got to work with Margot Smith, Johnny Gimble, Marilyn Sellers, Bill Anderson, and a few of the artists from the Prairie Home Companion, a bluegrass band called Stony Lonesome, and then later on, I started working at a place called the Midwest Country Music Theater, which is in Sandstone, Minnesota, and through that experience, I worked with David Frizzell. In fact, I got to sing a song with David Frizzell, and we worked with Farron Young's son, Robin Young, and this was after Farron Young had died. And I'm sure I'm leaving some people out. I got to work with Johnny Gimble, who was a great person, a great instrumentalist, and I can't even remember. Kenny Roberts was another one. I was also involved in another country music production in my teen years that was kind of similar to the one that Terry and I had. And so I'm sure I've left some people out, but I've worked with quite a few folks.
It sounds very impressive. I'll redeem myself a little bit. The two people that you mentioned that I have heard of, Marvin Rainwater and Farron Young. So I'll claim that I actually have heard of those people, but I'm sure the other people stateside were very impressed with that list, and I'm sure that lots and lots of them are familiar with those artists. And now this is a bit of a difficult question for you maybe, but how do you think they regarded you? Do you think they regarded you as just a singer, as the blind singer, you know? We always have to have the blind whatever tag, you know, the blind singer Marlene, or do you think they treated you like everyone else, or how do you think they interacted and reacted to you?
Well, I remember a neat thing that happened with Farron Young. One time, it was the time that we'd worked with him, and I wore this beautiful pink formal. I mean, it made me feel like a queen for a day. It really did. And I remember he came up to me and he put his arms around me, and of course he was kind of a ladies' man anyway, but he said, you know, he said, you look so beautiful in that dress, and he said, girls just don't dress like that anymore these days. And whether or not he was sincere, of course, it really impressed me. But I remember the last time we worked with Jack Green, that was one that I forgot to mention. He told me that I was a very good musician and that I caught on to things really well and things like that. So I guess, for the most part, I was actually treated very well by people. And I think people noticed the gift that I had been given of being able to, find chords and things like that. So I'll have to say I was treated very respectfully.
That's good to know. That's good, really, really good to know that they give you the respect that you're due to. But I'm sure you know why I asked you, because, sometimes we're not, and I just wondered how all these people had actually reacted to you. Now, from this side, from someone who knows very little about country music, I believe there are two different types, aren't there? From what we gather over here, there's what old country and new country. Now, briefly, if you can, briefly, can you explain to me, for one, the difference between old and new country, and which out of those two you prefer?
Well, I realize that things are kind of winding down here, and I feel bad. Man, the time just flew by. But country actually has several sub-genres, if you will, in it. There's bluegrass, there's western swing, there's Cajun, and they all fall into the realm of country. But as far as old and new country, basically, I think it has to do with more of a sound than it does whether it's old or new, because there can be recordings out now that you know, have a tendency to lean towards a traditional country sound with a fiddle and steel, and the typical more country-sounding band, and yet there are some of the country songs that are released type sound to the degree that some of it doesn't even resemble country in my estimation. But don't get me on that soapbox, or we'll be here till 6 o'clock.
It's okay, Mark, because over here it's 7:30 anyway, so don't worry. But that's very interesting. But I know what I like, and I do like both genres, shall we call it like that, that we actually get over here. I know it's very, very popular in the States, country music. It's reasonably popular over here, but not like it is over there. And what I've heard of both types, I do like. Okay, well, I don't want to go on too long, because you know, I don't know how Steve's recording time's getting on, but if we can just begin to wind down now. Out of all the experiences you've had and all the songs you've sung in various locations and things and people you've met, what would you say is your biggest thrill? What's given you the most pleasure out of everything, out of all of it?
Well, of course, you know, the first thing was recording in Nashville. And the second one, I'll have to say, is working with Johnny Gimble. He is a musician's musician. And doing that show made me the most nervous, because I know how revered he is in the circle of musicians. I mean, he was a studio session musician in Nashville for 10 years, and he played on numerous very popular recordings. And to have him on the same stage with us, I got so scared, and I almost resigned from that post, because I didn't think I was good enough to work with him. And I'm so glad that I didn't go through with that, because I would have missed out on such a wonderful experience, not only musically, but he as a person is so fantastic. And that was definitely the highlight of my musical experience.
And ambitions for the future? I take it that you've been performing as a singer all your working life. As I say, we're rapidly running out of time. I don't really want to let Steve's recording run out, because it's so interesting. I'd hate him to miss anything off the end. I take it you've been working as a singer all your life, and you're still working as a singer, I take it. Have you got any big, big ambition for the future? What would you really like to achieve in, say, the next 5-10 years?
Well, I actually have been working somewhat as a tutor for JAWS, and that's a whole another kettle of fish, but I really haven't been doing much with my music out here. I came out here to work as a part-time student aide at a college, ironically teaching, which is something that people were trying to encourage me to do to begin with. And I'm not a certified teacher, but I've been very successful with that. But I miss music. I want to get back into music. That is actually my goal. And I don't know if it's going to be here or somewhere else. I went to Georgia for a little while, had a 4-week music job there, and I found out that I could still cut it and still enjoy it as much as I ever did. And I just made up my mind that I've got to do music while my voice is still in its prime before it starts to deteriorate. So I really think what I'm going to do is to center all of my attentions. And I know I'll never be a star, but I would at least like to continue performing until I call the dogs in.
I'm sure you will. I've no idea you did tuition on JFW. Oh, Marlene, you know when you want to... No, we won't go down that road. I'll save that for another occasion. Okay, well, I'd like to thank you very much indeed. I know you've got another piece of music. In fact, you may have more than one piece. So I'll let you cue up your next piece of music, and I'll just take this opportunity to thank you. It's been thoroughly enjoyable. I've really enjoyed speaking to you, and I'm sure the people out there have enjoyed what you've had to say. And wish you all the very, very best in the future. And thank you very much indeed for agreeing to be interviewed.
Well, thank you so much, Steve, and I've enjoyed the experience as well. You're just great at interviewing. You ask some very interesting questions, and I thoroughly have enjoyed this time. It's just flown by. The other aspect of my life that we didn't cover just because it didn't actually come up was the fact that my belief in the Lord is very strong. And I believe that the reason that I'm here and the reason that my music has done so well is that God has given me such a special gift of singing, and it has opened a lot of doors for me that I wouldn't have ordinarily had open to me. And I have to bring that into it because it's the thing that keeps me humble about my music, because I know that if I ever abuse that gift, that God could take it away from me just as fast as he gave it to me. And this last song that I'm going to play has to do with that gift and how it has influenced me in my music and how it has inspired me to sing. And a lot of times I don't have the monetary resources to give people a gift, but if I can sing a song and make somebody smile, to me it's all worth it. This song is the title song for my inspirational album. I gave the song idea to a good friend of mine who wrote the words for me, and I wrote the music. And this is our collaboration, a song called The Power of Positive Singing.
One day as I was thinking about God's gift to me, of how he sent his son to earth to set my spirit free, I thought about just how my life had changed because of him, and how he was my guiding light that never would grow dim. Remembering the singing voice that God had blessed me with, I wondered, could I use my voice to praise and honor him? And now I thank him every day for the lessons he is bringing. It's all because he gave to me the power of positive singing. The power of positive singing, it gets me through each day. The power of positive singing, I know that it's God's way.
Marlene, that was terrific.
You're very welcome, and thanks for interviewing me.
Very nice job. Very nice job. Enjoyed that a lot. Did great job, Mar, and super job, Steve.